The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Hi there, and welcome to Report from Europe. I'm Marek Hansel, the editor of Institutional Real Estate Europe. And with me today, I'm very pleased to say, are Hans Vrensen and Dennis Schumacher from AEW. Hans is head of research and strategy at AEW Europe, and Dennis is an associate director in the investment research and strategy team. Hi there, Hans, Dennis. How are you both today?
Yes, good, Marek. Thanks for having us.
No, it's great to have you both on our podcast today. So today we'll be talking about some recent research that AEW have carried out. So they launched their 2021 Global Outlook, which is launching their Global Relative Value perspective recently. And it was produced in collaboration with their research teams in London, Paris, Boston, and Singapore. And the report can be found at www.aew.com/research. So using its risk-adjusted return approach methodology, AEW is able to identify mispriced opportunities across post-COVID-19 markets. And we're going to talk a little bit about this methodology and also try and find out a bit about which markets that Hans and Dennis believe look attractive for 2021. So, Hans, Dennis, perhaps we could kick off with the first question I have for you, which is asking a little bit about the methodology and laid out in this report. Obviously, it can help identify opportunities in the European and indeed the global real estate markets. How does it differ from other methods? And could you just sort of unpack it for us a little bit and explain how it works, if you like?
Sure. So maybe, Marek, I can sort of begin, and then Dennis can go into a bit more detail on some of the elements. So the approach is actually obviously launched before COVID-19 hit the markets. The difference now is that we are actually launching it on a global level. So we can do this analysis now for not just European markets where we have done it before, but now also across global markets, which we think is a useful way of having consistent type of analysis that takes into account the same variables to all the markets. And there's really two things that we're measuring, simplistically speaking, in this approach, is the expected rate of return, i.e. what can investors expect by investing in a certain market segment, and then the required rate of return, that is the return that we think the investor should earn to go and take the risks in that market segment. And they are not always the same. So that's, of course, the objective is to find places where the expected rate of return is above the required rate of return, because that is a market that is attractive. And so on the expected rate of return, we look at the income return as well as the capital value change. And to be fair, we use a range of econometric forecasting models for that. But we get not a lot of questions on that part of the approach. And this is maybe logical, because most investors that are in our markets are quite used to thinking in those terms. And so maybe, and this is where it might be useful for Dennis to spend a bit of time explaining the different elements of the required rate of return, because that's actually where we've gotten most of the questions so far on this approach, and maybe also where we differentiate ourselves a bit more from what other people are doing.
Sure.
So Dennis, you want to walk us through the different components of the required rate of return?
Yes, of course, Hans. And the required rate of return can basically be seen as kind of like a discount rate. But the four elements that we basically use in our approach are like the risk-free rate. We use a gross depreciation. We use a liquidity and volatility premium. So to dive into the first one, the risk-free rate is nothing more than the government bond yield for a 10-year maturity. And given the unprecedented environment that we find ourselves in, i.e. the negative yield environments, we have decided to cap these risk-free rates at zero. That's pretty straightforward. But then if we go to gross appreciation, there it becomes, I think, quite unique what we have used in our analysis. This is basically a net depreciation based on a publication done by MIT in Boston, where you look at the depreciation by building age. And then next to that, we've added data in Europe, for example, from INREF, which is the capital expenditure as a percentage of the building value. And these two together are the cross depreciation that we use in our approach. And of course, these differ for property types, but also by region. Important here is to note that the gross depreciation is time invariant, meaning that it stays constant over time. If we then go further, we can see that investors need to be compensated for the liquidity, i.e. illiquidity of a certain market. And here what we've done on a global level is using the real capital analytics data, and of course, looking at the investment volumes. Of course, we all know within the real estate market that there are many other different variables that we could use to measure liquidity. However, these are not consistently available. So what we therefore done is look at the RCA investment volumes and then rank them according to the 12 months moving average and then say, okay, we have the most liquid markets across our time frame and our universe, and then distributes basis points towards these markets. And then lastly, we were thinking with our team that investors also need to be compensated for markets that are more volatile because of the volatility that you have in terms of your capital preservation, which is of course important for many investors. To calculate this, we have looked at the volatility in the capital changes that Hans just mentioned. And we look at the capital changes because that is really where the volatility is, as income returns are very stable. And Hans, with these four elements in the required rate of return, how do we really look at the fact of what is really attractive versus what is less attractive? I think that's the main question to be answered after this.
Yeah. Well, obviously, as you can already tell from the methodology, we're obviously taking into account the perspective of a multi-asset investor. And so very simplistically, the markets that are attractive and to be fair, the results are from the report are that 70% of the markets globally in our methodology are rated as attractive. That means that the expected rate of return is ahead of the required rate of return, as Dennis has just explained. And when you look at the different regions in the universe that we are now able to cover, which is great to have Mike and Glenn's collaboration to include their markets, is that Europe actually does quite well. And you know, that means that especially on the office markets and the logistics markets, most of the European markets, in fact, all of the ones that are included in the global report are attractive. And then the retail markets are less attractive. In fact, a small majority of markets across the European landscape are, you know, less attractive. But then obviously we're covering the other regions as well, Dennis. So how does that contrast with the other regions as far as the results are concerned?
Yes, no, I think that's a very good question. And as you can see, like we have used 98 global property markets for our universe. And if we really look at the regional results, we really see that there's a lot of strength in logistics. And logistics is not only the strength in Europe, but it's also in the United States and in Asia Pacific, where we see a lot of strength within this sector. If we then switch to like offices in the US, it's still that 6 out of 10 markets in the office sector are attractive, meaning that the expected rate of return is outside of this 20% neutral zone that we use, because it's quite arbitrary to say whether an expected rate of return is just higher than a required rate of return. That's also why we use this neutral zone. And if we then look at Asia Pacific, we see that 5 out of the 10 markets are attractive there, and that's only 2 markets are less attractive in Asia Pacific. So that really shows that on average, what Hans already mentioned is 70% of global markets is attractive. And of course, we have to acknowledge that our expected rate of returns are the 21-24 period. So already after the most of the COVID impact.
Okay, oh, great. Thanks, Dennis. Okay, so Hans, you mentioned that 70% of global markets are attractive. Within Europe then, where do you think investors should be placing their money as far as you're concerned? You also mentioned logistics, obviously, and Dennis, you said US offices are looking good. Are European offices looking good, for example?
Yeah, in fact, out of the European offices, we don't have any in the neutral or less attractive category, but obviously it's still all relative. And I would say that the German office markets look particularly favorable at the moment. That is also due to the very low required rate of return. But to be fair, in logistics, you can also see attractive opportunities pretty much in all the markets that are included in this universe. And Paris also stands out as one of the more attractive markets in Europe. And so as maybe to highlight a few exceptions on the retail side, we already mentioned that for Europe overall, there is quite a number of unattractive markets, but Milan and Paris are, for example, two examples of markets that are still deemed to be attractive, where the required rate of return is met or actually exceeded by the expected rate of return. So that's maybe to just to name a few names of the markets we've highlighted in the report.
Okay. And did any of your findings surprise either of you or any of your colleagues from what you'd observed or perhaps what you'd expected?
Well, I think the biggest surprise really is that if you look at the big picture, if you just step back in the year of COVID, and obviously this year is extended into 2021 now with the continued lockdown and actually more severe lockdown now than before, is that despite all of this bad news and the massive impact of COVID-19 on macroeconomic indicators and potentially also on market rents, that actually 70% of the markets are still in attractive, deemed to be attractive. And that seems a bit counterintuitive at first, but when you think about what is driving our results, a lot of our results are driven by something that Dennis already highlighted a minute ago, which is the capital values. And those are preserved in the period of time that we are measuring it, because we are already looking at 2021 to 24. That means that the capital value declines in 2020 that were suffered are already behind us. And that's an important point. But also, I think maybe Dennis, you can elaborate a little bit on that, is that the low yields are expected to continue, and that drives a lot of our results.
Yes, no, that's correct, Hans. If we really look at the current yield environment and we look at the expectations, for example, of the market, is that we keep very low interest rates for a very long time. If we step a little bit back to see what happens, for example, from 2016 to 2020, where everybody was basically expecting some kind of interest rate normality, which maybe from the exception of the US really happened in a certain extent. However, in Europe, rates have always stayed very long and even have gone further negative within the timeframe of the COVID pandemic. And I think what has been staggering is also to see bond yields in Italy, in Portugal, in Greece, even go below almost 1% at the moment. So I think this convergence of government bond yields is a very important part of our view of capital preservation, as I would like to call it, in which we think that yields are very stable for the moment.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. And how confident are you that this environment will continue, this economic environment of low interest rates and obviously very low bond yields? I mean, some people have started putting out some scare stories about inflation and what have you, governments needed to try and inflate their way out of debt. Do you buy any of that?
It's something that we're closely looking at, and I do think it's such a crucial assumption in a lot of our thinking, and to be fair, it also impacts, of course, on all the other asset classes. It is definitely important to monitor all of these different things very, very closely. But there are a number of technical as well as more fundamental reasons to expect that this will continue for some time to come. First of all, on the technical side, the shortage of government bonds in the market to be traded is actually quite severe. This is also the reason why what Dennis highlighted a moment ago, that for smaller countries where there's still not a lot of bonds available in the open market. In the case of Italy, a lot of those bonds have been traditionally held by retail investors, but now also the ECB is also bidding for those bonds in the quantitative easing programs that they have. And I don't think that is going to change that dramatically. Also, another technical reason is that, of course, governments have continued to spend money to support the economies during this very tough period of the COVID lockdowns to keep smaller businesses going, in fact, to keep larger businesses afloat as well. And all of that spending will have to be financed somehow, which will probably increase the deficits of the governments going forward, which means that the already very high government deficits as a percentage of GDP will only increase. And that means that central banks will see an increased sensitivity, not only with governments, but also with corporations, where the debt levels are only sustainable if they keep the interest rates very, very low, the way they are now. As soon as they increase the interest rates, they will be seeing a lot more refinancings, a lot more defaults, a lot more bankruptcies going through the economy, and that will dampen the growth already further than what it has been hurt by. So those are some of the more technical factors, but there is also a more longer-term trend phenomenon that might be worth highlighting, and which is also not going away, Dennis. I mean, you and I have been talking about this phenomenon as well. Which is maybe interesting to highlight, is sort of a generational and demographic trend. Dennis, you want to talk a little bit more about that? Because that's not going to go away either.
No, you're completely right there. And this is like a topic that has been studied quite extensively already before we got into QE programs that have driven, of course, the other more fundamental reasons to the background. But the one Hans is really highlighting comes back to like the demographics, and it's basically like a life cycle hypothesis in where a large share of the global population is currently within like 40, 59 years old. And this share is increasing. So what happens basically, and what is really important for them, is the saving investment balance, because this group of people within 40, 59 mostly saves for their pensions, which also dampens interest rates. So this is like one of the more fundamental reasons, and we expect this to continue for the near term as well, and which would also therefore dampen interest rates into the future. However, and I think Marek, you made a great point there in the beginning, inflation is like the scary part, and we have not really seen any inflation in the Western world over the last 5 to 10 years. However, it's very difficult to expect or to forecast inflation going forward. But based on the information we have right now, we don't expect a heavy inflationary environment, but things can change rapidly, as we have seen this year with the COVID pandemic. But it is something we are very closely monitoring within our team. And I think the technical reasons highlighted by Hans, together with the fundamental reasons that we highlight, gives us a strong hypothesis to think that interest rates will keep lower for longer. Maybe not lower forever, but we really have to see what happens.
Well, forever is a long time, right? So I do think that market participants typically, I wouldn't say get complacent, because otherwise we wouldn't be talking about even the small sort of hiccups along the way in inflation that we're looking at. If we have global pandemics and we have trade wars and we have Brexit and all those sort of things, and we still see inflation at quite modest levels, we got to feel pretty good about that. And also central banks, especially in the US, and we talk with Mike about this all the time, is that he's actually seen a slight change in the long-term policy statement from the Fed. Now, the ECB hasn't necessarily confirmed that they will follow the same track, but their statement has been that since that they are targeting perhaps absolute price levels, that since the last 10 years has been super low in inflation, that we could expect a period of above average inflation before they take any policy action. And so it's a slightly fancy way of saying that they're not going to do anything very, very quickly. But it's still important, because in the past, the Fed has made a much more hawkish comments. And so they've been maybe pulling the trigger on rate increases a little bit more quickly. And in fact, 2018, 19, we had some examples of that where they were quite quick to increase rates. And clearly the market didn't like it. And a bit unfortunately, obviously, the COVID came around as well. Yeah. But that's maybe to add to that. So, we are definitely not complacent in viewing our key assumption as lower for longer bond yields. We will continue to look at that very, very closely to make sure that if and when the facts change, that we also change our minds. And because that is a key driver of what we're seeing on the relative value side.
Sure. Okay, great. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you both today, Hans and Dennis. Thanks so much for sharing shedding some light on your methodology and the report for us and our listeners. Anyway, so that's report from Europe today. Thanks again, Hans, and thanks, Dennis, for your time.
Thanks for having us, Merrick.
Thank you.